Everyone's very interested in the hard border. Yeah, I know. But there's a couple of flavours of the questioning that's been coming through, and also that I'm very interested in. And the first thing is about, you know, what's your view on a hard border? We've sent millions of tons of iron ore across the hard border. Let's face it, it's pretty permeable. And we get FIFO workers in and out of the state. Yeah. But how are you thinking about that? What's driving that hard border? Is it that protection of mining, or is it really health? How do you balance those two things out?
So the hard border, when you go back 6 months or 7 months, and you think about it, everything feels like it was years ago now. The great fear in Australia was around how do we get our health systems ready? The Premier's made, you know, the early data and the advice from the health officers was diabolical if it was sort of a rampant spread of the virus. And so early on it was about, okay, let's get the health systems ready. And we've done that. The health systems are ready, and we have been, even Victoria, if you look globally, even Victoria, we have been very successful in effectively almost in WA eliminating the virus, and most states are very close to that. So with the protection of the hard border, and you're right, there's all sorts of exemptions to the hard border that have, thankfully haven't sort of brought in the virus. It meant that the mining sector, people, etc., could move around the place and continue to do that. The thinking now is it was always then around, okay, with the Victorian, again, we all forget these things. We actually had a date set to consider moving to a control border a couple of months ago. Then the Victorian second wave hit, and that's really weighed any further decisions around that. So today, obviously, we met with the Chief Health Officer. The Premier will make some, he's going out at 1 o'clock to announce some changes to that, which I think people will be appreciative of. But it has been, it's been an interesting time because West Australians have the highest average income and highest disposable income, you know, in the nation. And we now get an understanding of how much you're all spending in Bali and Japan and Sydney and Melbourne, quite a lot apparently, because we spend way more in other states than other states spend here, and that's all been spent locally. So we've seen some incredible things that we could never have picked, but there has been. You're also now getting to understand, like, places like Kununurra are very much reliant upon, I guess, the grey nomads moving across borders, etc. So in some areas have had incredible outcomes, some not so strong. But again, one thing, when that May data I got from Treasury did not pick the largest increase in car sales in Western Australia on record, and it's still surging. It's incredible. We did not pick that at all. We thought a collapse in duty from car sales.
Yeah, I'm so there's been excited a, really excited about car. I just bought a new car yesterday. Very excited.
I nearly considered selling my Prado. Because I was going to get it, and, you know, could have got a new price on it. It was incredible.
So you've answered Lily's question, actually. She was really interested in, whether we lose more tourist dollars to other states than we get back from interstate tourism.
Yeah, it's about 1.4 we spend over and 1.2 they spend here. So it's about a $200 million difference on an annual basis with other states. This is an odd year. I mean, if you had 6 years of a hard border, that wouldn't be just replicated. So it's had an impact this year. And overseas, we spend a lot more overseas than overseas tourists spend here. But again, it's where they spend. So whilst we're moving around the place, your hotels with the higher yield rooms, we don't go there. You know, we're not spending $5,000 a night on a room. Whereas Chinese tourists or other tourists, it's the high yield hotels and the experience. So we'll go to Exmouth and we'll with our camper trailer and we'll eat in a restaurant, but we won't spend the money on a particular tour. So it's kind of where we spend. It's quite different.
Yeah, I saw that when I did my wander out yonder, like you told me to. Yeah, I've done a few trips and another one coming. And I went and flew out over the Abrolhos. And got to say, it was some of the best money I've ever spent.
Excellent.
But in talking to the owner of the charter flight operator, she said exactly the same thing. Australians just won't open their wallet for these types of things. But I've heard you say in the past that given the way we have managed COVID here, it just makes WA an even more attractive option for tourists and for international students. How are we going to get them back? What's the thinking about that?
Absolutely. Our great competitors for international tourists have been Europe and the United States, both of which are now, you know, seeing large second, third waves in some places of the virus. So I think Australia's, and WA in particular, has proven its mettle. Our government worked, you know, the National Cabinet worked, and we proved that Australia can actually, as a community, respond. I mean, that big, you talk about the contraction, I talked about the contraction in June, it's sort of, I try and describe that as that's a big wealth sacrifice we made as a state and as a nation to for our communal health, which is wonderful. Other countries have not been able to do that. So I think we will be much more competitive than as a place to come and live and invest and go to uni. So there's work going on now, Di, around how do we in particular, and in fact, a big part of the conversation with the treasurers this morning was around how do we bring students back, international students back. The Commonwealth government's already in this space, and it's about it's controlling the movement of people. We can do it. So we're keen to get back into that. I think there's probably a year where the universities will be able to replace a lot, some not all, but broadly, universities will be able to do a large replacement with domestic, but that's not sustainable. I think year in, year out, they'll still need to be. How do we move back to those students? I think we can. I never thought I'd ever know anything about quarantine, Di. I now fret about quarantine, and all the states are. So we can do this now. It's about how we control people, and the Prime Minister has made some noise already in public around, okay, maybe we start with countries that have had some success with the virus, and he's named those in Asia. So I think there's some sense to that. And I wouldn't be surprised if that really is the focus of the National Cabinet over the next maybe 3 to 6 months about how we do that.
Yeah, and look, I find those very encouraging comments, so I'm glad it's heading in
that
direction.
It's also the point I made around, you know, the reality is we need people. We're going to need people with skills, which fertility rate has dropped as well. Josh Frydenberg was telling me this morning. The fertility rate has dropped. Our net migration for the first time in 46 years is going to be negative. So even though we had, I think, population growth in WA 1920 of 1.3%, which is actually quite high, that's that one-off influx of people coming back. We're expecting in WA population growth for this financial year at 0.8, which is effectively our fertility rate. The Commonwealth is expecting us at 0.4, and we haven't quite worked out the difference there. And that has an impact on a range of different things that I'm interested in as Treasurer. This is going to be the next 2 years in Australia population, because we don't, like all advanced nations, we don't breed particularly well, and we have relied upon international migration to help us with that.
So you're going to be delighted to know that we've actually got a question that's managed to knock the hard border question off the top of the poll.
Good.
And this question comes from one of CEDA's State Advisory Council members, Vanessa Torres, sitting right there in the front row, who is the Chief Technical Officer at South32. So she wants you to look past the 2 years you just talked about and think about the next decade and what are going to be the key drivers of our economy, because we've so often heard about gas, iron ore, tourism, international education. And she'd like to know, and all the other people, yes, and there comes even one more vote for this question, what are we doing now that are going to set us towards that long-term growth?
Yeah, great question. The next 10 years, I think, for Australia and WA are incredibly optimistic. I just think we are now, more than we ever were, a place that people want to invest. So we talk about supply lines, et cetera, and I think over time there will be a drift back to, I guess, your cheaper supply lines, but there'll need to be there'll need to be more, I guess, robustness to them. When going into the virus, what was it that employ Western Australians? It was actually your services. It's health services in particular, disability services. We have a huge skills shortage there already. And with the NDIS rolling out, it's a problem for Australia, getting people into that space. So it is going to be the export of things we do well. We deliver health well in Australia. And it's going to be greater demand, I think, in our sort of Asian network. And said it's not going anywhere, and I still have big confidence in that, but it's then how do we utilise what they've done, particularly not in your renewable space. I think there's a lot of opportunity there, because you're seeing it. Banks say we're no longer financing coal. I think it's just simply because there won't be any demand to finance coal. That is just, so there's a shift happening that has been, I think, catalysed by COVID. The move to online, I think, is something that we're pretty good at in Australia, and government needs to be a lot better. But I just think what we can offer and the fact that people will want to live here in a way that I don't think we've probably seen since after the Second World War, there is going to be demand to come to Australia that we haven't seen in a long time, and I think that creates opportunity. We still don't really have an understanding of who's come back. A lot of people have come back, Australians have come back who have lived overseas for decades, and there is a skill set in there. The one area there I've really seen it emerge is when we put out our problem and opportunity statement for a movie studio. I kind of was a bit suspicious about that. But the demand, we've had 14 submissions on that, all of them are spectacular. Incredible money that wants to follow that in. Now, what's driving that? Probably because, again, safe, secure environment in Western Australia, and you know, rule of law, etc. You know your investment's protected. So we do have what we offer here now is these other opportunities that will come as a result. And government's not yet, I think, quite aware of what they're going to be. I think they're going to be quite interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting to see people coming back. You know, I mean, I think I've had three different people introduce me to people that have come back after like a decade at Google, you know, these sorts of things. So I think hopefully that's going to bring some new thinking and some innovation. We have a question along the lines of Vanessa's, but with a bit of a focus on, you know, what are the things that you're most excited around things like battery, minerals, hydrogen, you know, these sorts of things. You didn't talk too much about that sort of energy future. And it does seem to me that pretty much any time there's a new mineral that's needed for something, we seem to have more of it in WA than anywhere else in the world, or better quality.
Yeah, we do. And one of my charts that I skipped over towards the end there, I had the 5-minute sign waving at me up the back.
Should have ignored it, I always do.
We're following South Australia on the big battery. So we put in, I think, $17 million into the big battery. That'll be Kwinana, I think, is where that's going in. That is a good investment, but it's also actually important investment for the system that we have. You've all put solar panels on your roof and causing no ends of trouble for the actual system. So that's what the battery is there to help us with. But Western Australia, we're actually now at a point where energy demand is effectively, you know, pretty, it's plateaued, and it's going to sort of plateau for a long time yet. It's the makeup of that. And you see in Bill Johnson released a really interesting document what this looks like over the next 10 years. As coal assets are retired as part of our fleet, the state fleet, there's huge opportunity for these investments to come along. And you're seeing Warradarge and some very large investments in wind in particular. So there is a lot of Commonwealth and state money going in, and there's also funds being created for those. You know, hydrogen. Alana McKinnon is obsessed by hydrogen, for example, and so she's got a pot of money that I thought was in too large, but she seems to have no trouble getting it out the door because there is huge interest now around the planet in this new energy, but also because I think, as you said, people understand if ultimately, we've got really what you need, whether it be, you know, and the lithium story is going through some pressures at the moment. But again, everyone's fairly confident in the medium and longer term for lithium. It's just they've got to go through the current pain of the price, but they will.
Yeah, I mean, I think the supply-demand balance is not quite right there. But over time, as economies electrify everywhere, then I think we will see that happen. And I do think WA is incredibly well placed. There's a question around infrastructure from Carmelina. And Carmelina, I'm sorry, you've got a very long name, so the surname's been cut off and I can't work out how to... There we go. Thanks very much for your question. But Carmelina is interested in support for the SME business sector because obviously we've announced a lot of exciting infrastructure projects. These are really big things. And yes, that sort of headline spin eventually trickles down, but it can take a long time to get from there to there.
Yep.
What are you doing for the SME sector?
So the SME sector, in respect to that infrastructure spend, you're quite correct. And we've really gone to great lengths, particularly because the heavy lifting in the spend is road and rail. I think it's 40% of that $27 billion is road and rail. It's a combination, not just our spend, but the Commonwealth has gone heavy into roads because roads are quick. You generally can get them moving fairly quickly and they require a lot of labour. Rita Saffioti is from opposition. She was working on this and sort of trying to ensure that the capacity for that, I never like the term, it's the second tier, if you like. So it's not just your large international conglomerates that can get the work. It's, you have to structure your tenders accordingly so that others can access that. And that, and you've seen as a result, there is, I'm not going to name a couple, but you know, you could find it fairly easily, a local company that nearly fell over as a result of some work that really is now up and again because of contracts that we've been able to give at a state level, particularly on the sort of on the Metronet tenders. So we get that we have to do a lot more work. We are, and that's being playing out, whether it be our Aboriginal procurement policy that has been incredibly successful, and other buy local policies. It's pointless having a buy local policy if you're saying to, pitching for work in Broome or Geraldton or Kalgoorlie, an enormous $1 billion contract. No one's going to pitch for that. It's how you pitch it and how you actually break it up, which I think we've been quite successful at.
Okay, thank you. You know, people in the audience are interested in lots of different things. Mm. And I've got a couple of questions here that are really thinking about inclusiveness and thinking about sectors and issues that perhaps don't, you know, come in the headline of some of the work that you do. But there's a comment here from Nicholas about it's really positive to see a larger spend in mental health and particularly the youth mental health system. And I know there's been quite a lot of concerns about whether that actually works. And I think it plays into, you talked about the unemployment numbers being better, but I think if you dig through those, the youth unemployment numbers are not quite as encouraging.
No.
So I think these are two really allied issues and we'd be interested in hearing your thoughts.
So mental health, you're quite correct. So there has been a large increase, but I'll make some comments about it. So about, increased about $300 million in the mental health spend. So it brings it to now over $1 billion a year. But that increase, it needed to happen, but it's been very much focused on the acute end. There's no doubt about that. So how do we, I guess, move it to more of a focus on, ultimately you build a, it's like that, you build an emergency department, it's going to be full. So how do you sort of stop the flow into the emergency department? A lot of money's gone into the acute. We need to do some more work in that front end, if you like, with our community service providers. And you're right. And the youth unemployment numbers are frustrating. You go back over the last decade, and even during a period of time when you had unemployment numbers in WA, 3%, 3 point whatever percent, so very low, you still had spikes in youth unemployment. So it's not, youth unemployment often is slightly disconnected to the broader what's going on in the economy for various reasons, and this might be just the movement of young people into appropriate training or education. So it's one that is, which, and the Commonwealth also gets that, and even though I think their narrative, they got a bit critiqued for, the focus for under 35, I actually understand what they're trying to achieve there, because the big problem is a young person who doesn't get a job for 10 years generally is very, very difficult to then train and find an opportunity for them. So a lot of the effort is now going from the Commonwealth and state in removing all obstacles to training or skilling, in whether it be you want to do something, we will fund it. You're not going to have to pay, and there will be more announcements around priority areas from both the state and the Commonwealth over the next little while. But there is a slight disconnect, for whatever reason, between the youth unemployment rate and the broader economy. It's not one that naturally follows like the headline unemployment rate tends to do. But there is a lot, this is going to be the long-term issue, I think, for the next 2 or 3 years, and maybe longer, the impacts on mental health, which we don't really know yet, border restrictions, the fact that international travel is effectively stopped, and we have a lot of families disconnected now, that will have an impact. But it can't just be the acute end, because I see that every time in the health budget, which is the beast of the budget, of the entire budget. You can spend your life on that kind of acute end, And it just, it's like you build a prison, it'll be full immediately. It's the same with an emergency department. You build it, it's full. It's the other end that we need to spend effort on. And that's our sustainable health review made that point very, very clearly. The frustration for governments is that's often a 10-year result. With a 4-year electoral cycle, you're desperate to get results quicker. But it is shifting, I think. People, mental health now is getting a lot more as it should have, but not at that front end, which I'll be honest about. We do need to do more there.
Yeah, and I must admit, I'm a great believer that a job is one of the best things for your mental health.
Absolutely.
And so I'm sure that we'll see some youth employment initiatives coming out of some of your surplus.
And you see as well, historically, with high unemployment rate, this, and not just the Commonwealth spend, of course, on the various welfare supports, but health demands also spike with high unemployment. You sort of look back over time for that very reason.
Yeah, indeed. Now, you know, it is not very often that I am in possession of a piece of information that you're not in possession of, that you actually...
Sure, that's not true.
No, I hadn't finished quite. That you actually need to have.
Okay.
Right? You actually need to go.
Oh.
Your office has been in touch and you are required. So I'm really sorry, even though I know you were quite happy to go on for another 20 minutes, we are going to have to stop now so that you can go. So let me thank you wide-ranging comments as I tip you out the door. Can we thank the Treasurer first?
Thank you, Brian. Thank you.